Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Get your advanced PhD in WOW from Floor and Decor. If you're a pro, you're already an expert in tile, wood, and stone. And with Floor and Decor's job site delivery, their free design services, and pro rewards that actually reward you, your business is set to grow from one client to the next. Floor and Decor isn't just a couple of aisles. It's an entire store designed to help your business boom. It's Floor and Decor. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. When authors Doug Stone and Bruce Patton were researching their book, Difficult Conversations, they asked people what they felt was their most difficult conversation to have in both their personal lives and in their career. And time again, people pointed to conversations involving feedback. They didn't like giving it, and they especially didn't like receiving it, even when the feedback was meant to be constructive. But here's the thing, knowing how to give and receive feedback is essential for our personal and professional growth. To remedy the discomfort we have with feedback, most books and articles focus on how the giver of the feedback can take the sting out of his delivery with tactics like the ever-popular criticism sandwich. But Doug Stone argues that in his latest book, when it comes to feedback, we should be focusing on how we can be better receivers of it. Stone is the author of the book Thanks for the Feedback, The Science and Art of Receiving Feedback Well, and today he joins me on the show to discuss why constructive criticism is so hard to take, as well as brass tacks advice on how you can be less defensive and more open to the feedback you receive on a daily basis. You'll want to take notes with this episode. It's crammed with information that can improve your life immediately. After the show's over, check out the show notes at aom.is/feedback. Doug Stone, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
So you are the author of a book called Thanks for the Feedback. You previously wrote a book called Difficult Conversations, co-authored a book called Difficult Conversations, which is a great book. I've read that one as well. But what I thought was interesting, the research and writing of that book, you all uncovered that the most difficult conversation that people reported having was giving and receiving feedback. What is it about feedback that just makes it hard to give and people hate doing it?
Yeah. Well, I have this sort of weird job where, among other things, I go into organizations or communities or work with families. And one of the first questions I ask them, I'm working with them on communication, how to communicate more clearly. One of the first questions I ask them are, what are some of your hardest conversations? What are some examples? And we make a list. And pretty much without fail, they'll always put giving and receiving feedback on the list. And that applies whether it's some global corporation or just some smaller group. It seems to be a universal human challenge, giving feedback. And so that was, once we started realizing that that was such a common pattern, we decided to really try to focus on that question.
So what I thought was interesting, the way you guys approach this, though, is that, most books and articles you see about how to make feedback better focus on the giver, right? So you do the compliment sandwich. Start off with something good you like, give the feedback, and then start with the end with a compliment. But you argue in the book that gets the solution to the problem backwards, and instead we should focus on the receiver of the feedback. Why is that?
Yeah, well, the compliment sandwich, by the way, it's not a terrible idea. The idea of starting positive, then negative, then positive. But the problem is, of course, if you gave someone a sandwich that had bread, ham, and bread, they wouldn't call it a bread sandwich or a bread, ham, and bread sandwich. They'd just call it a ham sandwich because they know the thing in the middle is the important part. So the challenge with the compliment sandwich is, especially if people notice that it's a pattern, they kind of dismiss the positive stuff and then they just take on the negative stuff so it doesn't end up serving the purpose that maybe it should. Our angle on this was to focus on the people receiving the feedback rather than the people giving the feedback. And again, from where I sit, we were getting called in by organizations to help train their managers in how to give feedback better, which makes sense to us. So we went and we did that. And we did it a bunch. And over time, what we found is the people that we were working with would say, yeah, this is helping a little bit. People are getting better at it. But the whole system still isn't working as well as we're hoping or as well as we'd like. And we started thinking about that. And we were thinking, you know, what else can we teach people about how to give feedback? And it suddenly dawned on us, just like stunningly obvious, that there are two people in that conversation, right? There's a feedback giver and a feedback receiver. And we're focusing all our energy on how do you get better as a feedback giver? And there's only so far you can go. You can go from not good to pretty good or pretty good to very good. But at the end of the day, the person who is deciding what that feedback means, whether to take it, is the person on the receiving end. And so we started looking at the whole question from that point of view.
Right. And that could be a hard sell to say that for the receiver to improve their improving how they receive feedback. It's like, listen here, I got this feedback I'm going to give you, like what you're doing wrong, and here's how you can actually listen to me better.
It is a hard sell, exactly. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a hard sell. But so let's talk about this. Like, what makes receiving feedback so difficult? So you argue in the book there's two tensions inside of us that make receiving feedback sort of hard to swallow.
Yeah. So just as human beings, we all have two driving needs. Well, we have a bunch of them, but among others, we have two. And one is we do want to learn and get better and improve. And if you ask anybody whether they want to learn and get better and improve, everybody says yes. At the same time, we want to feel like the people around us, the people we work with, the people we live with, the people we care about, accept us and love us and appreciate us the way we are now. And so we, on the one hand, we want to get better, which means we need to sort of hear feedback, take it, engage with it. And on the other hand, we are kind of stuck because we're thinking, well, what does that mean? If they're giving me all this feedback, what does that mean about me? What does that mean about whether I'm okay the way I am now? And so it's a difficult place to be. And it's not because there's something wrong with any individual person that they don't like getting feedback. I think it's pretty universal.
Right. And so you say there's three obstacles, or what you call triggers, that blocks us from, you know, getting to that point where we want to get better. We listen to feedback to get better. These triggers cause us to get defensive. What are those obstacles?
Yeah. So when we studied this, we realized that there's a million reasons people don't take feedback. And you could just make a huge list and say, here's a million reasons why we get in trouble. But what, you know, a reader or somebody who's learning about this can't really do anything with a list of a million reasons or even 50 reasons. So what we try to do is just break them down into three key categories, three kinds of triggers that we all have that can set us off. And the first is the most obvious, which is what we call the truth trigger. And this just, if I get feedback that says, you know, you were sort of dominating that meeting or you were talking over people, and I'm thinking that's just wrong, you know, either because I don't think I was talking that much, or in an extreme example, maybe I wasn't at the meeting. So it's like literally actually wrong. If we get feedback that we think is wrong, we're not going to take it. And reading this book about feedback, people think, well, so if receiving feedback is a good thing and that's how you learn, does that mean I have to take all feedback, even if it's wrong? And of course, the answer is no, right? We have enough feedback that's right and useful. We don't need to be taking feedback that's actually wrong. That's going to send us in the wrong direction. So the key around the truth trigger, and we can get more into this in a bit, isn't that, well, we should just assume all feedback is helpful and right and accurate, but just that we're probably rejecting feedback before we even understand what it actually means. And that's a common pattern. A second trigger is what we call relationship triggers. And this is not so much about the substance of the feedback, right? It's not so much the content of what someone's saying, but just sort of who that person is, who's the person giving it to me, right? So we're going to hear feedback differently if it comes from our spouse or our partner or our parent or our boss or our child or our neighbor or someone we like, someone we don't like, someone we trust, someone we don't trust. And we tend to let the sort of who dominate the what. And in our view, it's important just to separate those out, to think about, you know, who's giving me this feedback and what's my reaction to it. But is, even if I don't necessarily trust this person, is there anything that might be legitimate or useful to me in what they're saying? And then the third trigger is what we call identity triggers. And this is mostly about what does the feedback say about who I am and how I see myself? And when feedback feels, you know, you get feedback that you're not a good parent or not a good boyfriend, or, you know, the presentation didn't go well, it's very easy to let that sort of get out of control and just start thinking like, well, what does this mean about me and what kind of person am I and what do people really think about me? And we start getting so lost in that we're not really even taking in the feedback anymore.
Gotcha. So let's go into these triggers and how to overcome them in more detail. So the truth trigger, you start off in that section about breaking down the types of feedback that we get. And you say there's three. There's appreciation feedback, coaching feedback, and evaluation feedback. Can you briefly describe what each type of feedback looks like? And then we'll talk about how those things can get mixed together and cause problems.
Yeah, exactly. So imagine your partner or roommate or spouse has been cooking meals for you in the evening, and let's say they've made meatloaf for the last 30 nights. Let's say you want to give them feedback on this meatloaf. Appreciation would say, honey, I'm so grateful to you for putting all this time in, making the meatloaf. It means a lot to me, right? So that's appreciation. We know what that is. Coaching would be offering advice on how the meatloaf can improve. So you might say, I think meatloaf tastes better if it's fully defrosted before it's served. So you might have some little cooking tips there. And evaluation sort of ranks the person or the effort. So you might say, well, we've been having this 30 days in a row, and day 17, you know, this feedback was in the top third of all the meatloaf that you've made. And so each of these, appreciation, coaching, and evaluation, have different purposes behind them. And as you say, and we can get into, they get sort of mixed up, and that's one of the things that makes feedback the toughest.
Yeah, so let's talk about how can they get mixed up, and why does that cause problems?
Yeah, so the one of the first things that happens is that appreciation just drops out. And, you know, in the workplace, I think people just feel like, well, we're busy. People are getting a paycheck. The negative feedback is always an emergency, right? You know, you've got to turn this document around. You've got to get this out. Those are emergencies. It's never an emergency to pull somebody aside and say, thank you, that was a really great effort. So appreciation can easily drop out, but studies have shown that the U.S. Department of Labor did a couple studies where they found that over 90% of American workers feel underappreciated at work, which is kind of a staggering statistic. And a similar stat, they found that people who leave their jobs voluntarily, in other words, they're not fired, but they quit, cite a lack of appreciation as the number one reason. About 50% of people say lack of appreciation as the number one reason. So when appreciation drops out, it really has a potentially very negative effect on the relationship. Appreciation, I think it's, as with the feedback sandwich that we started with, we can often give appreciation that sounds like, you know, we say, hey, great job, that's the appreciation. Then the things we want them to do differently, we say, I've got a list of 100 things that I want you to change. And then at the end we say, and by the way, great job. So the positive appreciation is incredibly general, and it's not attached to anything. The person has no reason to believe that it means anything. And then the negative things, the things that actually need some action, are very specific. And it's actually quite useful to try to offer specific appreciation, specific positive things that the person is doing well, partly because it makes them feel good, and partly also that teaches them that those are things that they should keep doing. So one of the key challenges is that appreciation drops out, and that can be rough on the relationship. The other key thing that the sort of common dynamic is that coaching and evaluation get confused, and that we often hear coaching as evaluation. And I'll give you an example. It's just a simple example. Imagine you're driving and you have a passenger, and you can imagine whoever you want as your passenger, but the passenger just says, "Hey, slow down, you're driving too fast." So what is that? What's the message there? You could hear that in two ways. You could hear that as coaching, like drive a little bit slower, it's safer. There's, you know, that's going to be a useful tip around your driving skills. Or you could hear it as evaluation, like you're a reckless person, or you're, you know, you don't care about safety. And the person might be saying one or the other of those. But as human beings, we often tend to hear the evaluation that's given, and the coaching drops out. So the part that's going to help us actually get better at something, if somebody has actual driving tips for us that might be useful to us, we're not going to hear them if we just get into an argument about, you know, why are you always criticizing my driving, et cetera.
So how do you separate coaching and evaluation? Like when you're having that, when someone's giving you feedback, like, do you stop the conversations? Like, are you trying to offer some advice? Or are you evaluating me? I mean, like, do you have to be so obvious about it, or are there subtle ways to separate the two?
Yeah. So, you know, I think in like a formal work conversation, you can separate them out just by literally raising them, saying like, is the purpose of this conversation to rate me in some way, to rank me, or is it coaching? In personal conversations, you know, a big thing that I've been working on in my own life is just trying to change the default assumption that I have about what the person is doing. Because very often my default assumption, and I think this is true for a lot of us, is that I hear it as evaluation. I hear it as just criticism about who I am. So if they're commenting on my driving or the way I dress or my presentation, and, you know, it's very easy to hear it as you're not good enough, there's something wrong with you, you're an idiot, whatever. And that's my sort of default. So when I get feedback, if I'm giving a presentation and there's a break and someone comes up to me and says, "Hey, you know, I think it would be good if we did an exercise after the break." You know, that sounds pretty clearly like it's intended as coaching. It's intended as advice to help me do something better. But if I'm hearing it as evaluation, which is my own tendency, then I'm just going to hear it as, you know, your presentation stinks, and we just wanted you to know that. And so now I feel bad. Plus, there's nothing I can do, right? Just like, okay, you don't think I'm good at this. That's where we're at. If I hear it as coaching, it's not a critique. It's not an evaluation. It's not a ranking. It's just an idea that I can try to take on board or not, something that will help me learn and improve and get better, which is pretty much the whole point of the feedback in the first place.
Yeah, and I think another point you made was too, is when you ask for feedback, make sure you know what you're actually looking for. I think sometimes people ask for feedback from people, and when you ask someone, "I want some feedback," they're thinking, "Oh, they want me to coach them or evaluate this." But like, the asker is really wanting some appreciation. Like, "Hey, this is, you did a good job. Keep going at it," you know. But and then they don't get that, and they get all upset.
Yeah, exactly. I've been taking some guitar lessons recently, just trying to pick up from my sort of high school guitar skills. And, you know, I'm a pretty rudimentary guitar player, to say the least. And I had sort of learned this one thing, and I played it for my teacher. And what I really wanted was for my teacher to say, "Wow, look at that. Like, you actually played something, and it almost sounded like something." And what he said instead was, "Okay, so here's a couple ways you could fix that or improve that." And I was just thinking, yeah, this is not meeting me where I'm at right now. So it's very easy to get those confused, and it can be rough when that happens.
I think that's some good insight for the giver of feedback. You know, I guess when someone's starting out with something, a beginner, they probably need more appreciation, more positive evaluation to keep them going. And then as they get better, that's when you can start giving more of the coaching right? And the fine tuning.
Yeah, exactly. I had a teaching assistant once who kept saying, you know, give me more coaching, give me more coaching. And I kept saying like, okay, so next time you could do this differently and this differently. And then she would say, no, but give me more coaching. and it was sort of like, she kind of wouldn't stop. And I was thinking like, wow, I've told you everything I know. And I don't know how much more of this you can even take on board. And finally it occurred to me, she's asking for sort of advice on how to improve, but I hadn't really given much global appreciation. And I just sort of stepped back and I said, you know, something occurs to me that I haven't said, which is, you're just really good at this. Like, if you keep doing this, you're going to be good at this. You have a lot of passion and talent for this. And she was just so, that was like exactly where she was at. That was what she needed to hear. And as you say, I think that's right. Especially at the beginning when people are trying to get their feet under them, that kind of feedback can be just, you know, more important than any other, than the best, most brilliant piece of advice.
So going back to this truth obstacle, you know, one of our, I think, knee-jerk reactions when we receive feedback is trying to find out why that feedback's wrong. Like, why is this guy wrong and why am I right? And it's natural, but how can we overcome that knee-jerk reaction and actually listen to or consider the feedback with, you know, like you said, you don't have to necessarily accept it, but at least consider it.
Yeah, exactly. So when we're taking in feedback, we're hearing it through the question in our head. The question in our head that's playing is, what's wrong with this feedback? And if that's the question that you have, there's always going to be something wrong with it, right? It's out of date. It was a month ago that happened, or it was 5 minutes ago that happened. It's not true anymore. Or you talk to the wrong people, or you didn't put the feedback quite the right way. There's always something wrong with feedback. And so if we sort of throw out feedback just based on spotting something that's wrong with it, we're always going to end up throwing out all the feedback. It's not that we should therefore ask the question, you know, it's not that we should just say, okay, well, if I'm not supposed to ask what's wrong, I'll just assume it's right and take all the feedback, because as we said before, that's not going to be useful. But so it's fine to ask what's wrong with it, but we also need to pair that with its sort of sister question, which is, what's right about this feedback? What could I actually learn? What might be useful about this? It's sort of like if you went into a clothing store and you tried on a pair of pants and they didn't fit, and you just walked out and said, well, the clothes in the store don't fit. And, you know, it would be pretty reasonable to say, well, you tried on one pair and they didn't fit. They've got 100 other pair of pants. And it's the same with feedback, where we think if we can find one thing wrong with it, then that feedback we're just going to throw it at. But better to actually step back and say, you know, is there anything here that might be useful to me, that might make sense to me, that might actually help me?
And I think another issue that gets to this truth trigger is that there's often a miscommunication about what's going on, what's actually happening. So there's these blind spots that exist. So like, people can't read your brain. They can't read your mind. So you might have intended something, and they give you feedback that says, well, no, you're doing this. This is what your intention was, but like, that wasn't your intention. You're actually trying to do this thing that they said that you weren't trying to do. So right. How do you close that gap between the giver and the receiver about feedback, or about the truth of feedback?
Yeah. So this whole topic of blind spots is really fascinating. I think everyone would agree that human beings have blind spots. And what they mean by that is other people have blind spots. It's very hard for us, even just conceptually, to think of ourselves as having blind spots. And by blind spots, yeah, a couple of examples are things like our facial expressions. If you think about sitting in a meeting in a work setting, or in a family, you know, sitting around a family dinner table, everybody else in that setting can see your face. The only person who can't see your face is yourself. And so they all have this information about you, which is what your face looks like right now, which is information that you literally don't have. And you sort of imagine what you think your face looks like, or what you imagine your face is conveying, if anything. And sometimes the way you imagine is right, and sometimes your face is kind of giving off information or communication that is different, either different in the sense that it's not what you intended, or sometimes it's different in the sense that it's exactly what you're actually thinking, but didn't necessarily want to be saying. I was working with an executive a few years back, and she had just gotten a bunch of feedback that said that, you know, her team members were down on her and didn't think she was doing a good job and found her very difficult to work with. And this was particularly disturbing because she'd gotten the same feedback 3 years ago, and she was really working on it, and she was proud of herself for being easier to work with. And then lo and behold, 3 years later, feedback swings around again, and she gets the same critique. And I said, well, what do you make of this? What's causing this? Why do you think people are finding you difficult to work with? And she said, well, here's what I think. I don't think I am difficult to work with. I think it's political. You know, everyone likes shooting down their boss. It's just, you know, there's other stuff going on. And then, and she assured me that she was a friendly, compassionate person. And then her cell phone rang and she took the call as I was standing there, and I could hear her side of the conversation, obviously. And it was a colleague, a subordinate of hers, who had called to ask a question. And her response sounded essentially like this. She said, no, I'm in a meeting right now. I told you, that's the kind of thing you should be finding out on your own. I told you not to bother me with these kinds of questions. Thank you. And then she hung up and she said, see, this is the problem. You know, the people I'm working with, they have no initiative. They keep bothering me with these questions. But as you could hear, I'm very polite. I explain things to people. So I don't know exactly what's causing the problem. And what I could hear and what her colleague could hear that she apparently wasn't hearing was that her tone of voice is filled with contempt for this person and frustration, right? So a person on the other end of the phone isn't thinking, okay, so you're coaching me on how to, you know, do things on my own, and you're saying thank you at the end, so this is all good. The person's hearing the frustration as the key message, or the contempt, you know, you're not smart enough, you're not good enough, you don't work hard enough. And so when they evaluate her, that's what they're evaluating. And it's just a blind spot from her point of view. It's not that she's a bad person or that she's pretending. She literally didn't know that she was giving out those messages.
That's a hard problem to solve too, because like in her mind, she thought that she was genuinely trying to be more easier to get along with, easier to work with, but like that actually wasn't happening.
Exactly.
So I mean, how do you solve that problem? Like when you think, oh yeah, I am doing this thing, but you're actually not doing this thing. How do you overcome that?
Yeah, exactly. Well, so it is hard. Just by definition, right? These are blind spots, and if you could see them easily, they would have a different name. But the thing that I've seen work best is to begin to notice these gaps where you think you're doing something well and you're getting feedback not just once and not just from one person, but from different sources that say, no, actually, you're not doing this well. What we tend to do is we explain that gap by some other, we put in some explanation like it's political or they're jealous. These are very common examples. People will fill in that gap by saying, well, they're jealous of me because I'm successful or I'm good at this, et cetera. And so the awareness for us has to be built around sort of that starting point where we think we're one way, and we do hear the feedback that we're maybe not so easy to work with in this example. But instead of saying like I have to explain it away, just sort of sit with it and say, you know, it's possible that people are giving me this feedback because they're jealous, or it's possible that they're giving me this feedback because there's some political thing going on. But what if it were a different reason? What if the feedback were in some way legitimate and important? How could I make sense of that? And then, you know, a place to go is to think about what are some of the common blind spots that we all have. And there's the list isn't that long. It's things around, you know, body language, facial expressions, tone of voice, and so forth. And so once you start seeing those gaps and you start sort of running through that, you can at least begin to get a sense of it. And then once you have a sense that maybe that's what's going on, you can talk to a friend or colleague and sort of urge them to tell you the truth, not just the friendly thing, but, you know, to say, look, I think I'm getting feedback here that might be in a blind spot. So I want you to let me know if, you know, how this looks from your perspective.
Okay. So you're asking them to tell them the hard truth. For those who embrace the impossible, the Defender 110 is up for the adventure. This iconic vehicle has been redefined with a thoroughly modern design. The exterior is reimagined with compelling proportions and precise detailing, and the interior is built with robust materials and integrity. The Defender capability is legendary, whether you're facing off-road challenges or harsh weather conditions. The Defender 110 lets you go further and do more. It's built for the modern explorer. They've got lots of cargo space, so you've got plenty of room for your gear. They also have powerful innovations like the intuitive driver display and award-winning infotainment system that keeps you connected. And they have an innovative camera technology system that delivers unobstructed views and effortless maneuvering. It is ready for a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. A vehicle made to go further, the Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. There are millions of workers, but there's only one you, with only one body. So why wear it down with lesser power tools? You deserve ease. You deserve safety. You deserve Bosch. With Bosch tools, you can raise the X-Lock, hammer drill, or 2-in-1 with pride and know that you deserve it. Now lower it, safety first. Bosch tools, what hard workers deserve. Did you know Fast-Growing Trees is the biggest online nursery in the U.S. with more than 10,000 different kinds of plants and over 2 million happy customers in the United States? They have everything you could possibly want, like fruit trees, palm trees, evergreens, houseplants, and so much more. Fast-Growing Trees makes it easy to order online, and your plants are shipped directly to your door in 1 to 2 days. So I got a tree from Fast-Growing Trees. I had a tree in my front yard that I had to cut down, a big giant oak tree, because it died, and I wanted to put a maple tree there, one that turned this bright red during the fall. So I found that tree, made sure that it fit the climate that we're at here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Ordered it. A few days later, I got the tree in a box. It's crazy they can send a tree in a box. And I planted it. A few weeks after I planted it, it's already starting to sprout leaves. So I think in a few years, I'm going to have that bright red maple tree that happens in the fall. I'm really looking forward to that. So if you want to try Fast Growing Trees out, this spring they have the best deals online, up to half off on select plants and other deals. And listeners to our show get an additional 15% off with their first purchase when using code manliness at checkout. That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using code manliness at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com, code manliness. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code manliness to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code manliness. Check it out today. Let's switch over to relationship triggers. I think we've all experienced this, right? I mean, I remember as a kid, if my parents gave me feedback on something, I'd just be like, roll my eyes and just like, oh my gosh, you guys don't know anything. But then if some coach or teacher or stranger gave me the exact same advice, I'm like, oh yeah, this person knows what they're talking about. I'm gonna follow this advice. So I think we all intuitively understand why relationships can affect how we receive feedback. One of the interesting things I thought you hit on, because I've seen this in my own life, is this idea of switch track conversations that can happen because of a relationship. So what are switch track conversations?
So in the book, we give, I think, a great example that's also a fun example. People at this point probably know the comedian Louis C.K., and he's a stand-up comic, and he currently has a show called Louis on cable. But before that show, he had a prior show called Lucky Louie. And there's a scene, so in that show, he's married to his wife, obviously. And he's about to have a romantic weekend with her. And he brings her red roses as a gift. And the first thing out of her mouth is, you know, I don't like red roses, remember? And then the next thing out of his mouth is, you know, whether you like red roses or not, a polite person says thank you for the roses, and then you can comment on whether you like them or not. And then she says, why would I thank you for something that I don't want? And they sort of go back and forth like this. And it's when I was watching it, I was thinking, you know, this is it's like a marital argument, and it feels very real and typical. And then it suddenly occurred to me that what was going on was this dynamic of what in the book we call switch tracking, where these two people are almost in two different conversations. Like it sounds like they're talking about the roses, and they're both talking about the roses. So you think, well, maybe they're talking about the same thing. But in fact, the wife is saying, you don't listen to me. I've told you before that I don't like red roses. You don't listen to me. And the husband is saying, you don't appreciate me. I try to do nice things for you and you don't appreciate me. Those are just two different conversations. You can't have those at the same time, you know, sort of in a back and forth. You actually have to separate out those two topics and have each of them separately. And you know, they're not easy conversations to have separately either, but there's at least some chance that the husband, or Louis in this case, could say, so it sounds like you think I don't listen to you. Tell me more about that. Let's talk about that. And then he could swing around and say, so the other thing that's going on here is I feel like you don't appreciate the efforts that I make. And then they could talk about that. And there you at least have a chance to get through both these conversations in a useful way. But once you start noticing that dynamic of switch tracking, it's unbelievable how common it is in our lives, where we get or give feedback. Let's say we get feedback, and instead of responding to the content of the feedback, we respond to how it's delivered, or who's giving it to us, or what time. You know, how could you send that bad news by email? How could you send it on, you know, Friday at 5 o'clock? Not that those may be legitimate conversations to have, but they're additional to whatever the actual underlying feedback was about.
Yeah, and I think it's mainly like a defense mechanism, because I know I do that, right? When my wife will bring something up, I'll say, well, like, you know, you really could have said that differently. And like, I just completely ignore the feedback. I'm just trying to trying to protect my ego by throwing, hey, you're not so great either, because you do this thing.
Exactly. I think that's right. It's partly a defense mechanism, but it's partly just, it's a real thing. In other words, if you feel like you're either getting too much criticism or you're not appreciated for what you do well, when someone criticizes you, the thing that's in your head is, well, wait a second, what about all the times where I didn't do that? And so you're trying to defend yourself, but you're trying to defend yourself not to, you know, get out of looking at the truth. You're trying to defend yourself because you feel like this is a legitimate, important topic, and it is. The challenge is just that it needs to be a separate conversation. You know, if you comment on the house is not neat or whatever, and the person storms out of the room, you know, what is it that's triggering them? Let's talk about that. And let's also talk about sort of what are the rules about how we keep the house clean.
So how does the dynamic of a relationship affect whether you get into these switch track conversations? I mean, is it if there's like a lot of tension, you're likely to more likely to move to these switch track conversations, or if there's less tension, you're less likely to do it?
Yeah, I think if there's more tension, we're more likely. But I think we all actually fall into them pretty commonly. That just think how common it is to say things like, "I can't believe they told me that," you know, at 5 on Friday, or I don't like, you know, I can't believe they broke up with me on the telephone. That kind of thing. We're just very sensitive, and I think rightly so, to sort of the way feedback is delivered and the timing of it, and the you know, does the person appreciate us or not? so it just, it comes up constantly. And again, the answer isn't to pretend that you don't have your own concerns. For example, with Louis and the flowers, the answer is not for him to say, okay, I'll start listening to you from now on, and now we're done. The answer is for him to talk about her topic, which is listening, but then for him separately to talk about his topic, which is appreciation.
All right, so be aware of it. So what can we do to mitigate relationship triggers when we're giving and receiving feedback, right? I mean, like I said in that earlier example, like your parents or your wife could give you a set of advice, but you just ignore it because like they're your parents and your wife. But if some complete stranger gives you advice, you're like, oh yeah, I'm going to listen. That's actually a good point. So how do you overcome that bias of just totally disregarding advice if it comes from someone close to you, even though it might be useful?
A few things. I mean, I think the first thing is just to be aware of that, right? To notice when you're in a pattern where your wife or a relationship or somebody is giving you feedback over and over again, and you've kind of stopped hearing it because it's your parent or spouse or whatever. And just to ask yourself, okay, so what's going on here? I'm not taking this feedback because they're annoying me or because this is, you know, it's my parent being critical or whatever. And to if you choose to try to make that discussable, to say, like in a marriage, to say, look, you know, every day you spend the day criticizing me for not taking out the garbage, you know, the 100 things that I'm doing wrong. Let's see if we can figure this out so we don't have to keep having the same conversation. Just making it explicit. And if it, you know, at the same time, when we're sort of beaten down by too much feedback from the same person, it's fine to say, and probably useful to say, this feedback's not helpful anymore. There's nothing new in this feedback for me. You know, I'm trying to change, or here's the limits of what I can do, but you just giving me this feedback over and over again isn't doing anything for me in terms of actually fixing the problem.
So you argue in the book that the way we receive feedback and handle it can often be determined by our wiring and temperament. How so?
Yeah, so there's this in psychology, some people subscribe to what they call the 50-40-10 rule. And I don't know about the exact percentages, but the idea of it is that about 50% of how we react in the world to feedback or to bad news or to setbacks is just based on our wiring, our constitution, you know, our sort of neurology. And 10%, the 50-40-10, so 50 is wiring, 10% is based on the actual situation that's going on around us. So we're getting the bad news, you know, we didn't get the pay raise or whatever it was. And that leaves this 40%, and the 40% of how we react in any given situation isn't based on our wiring, and it's not based on the actual situation. And so you say, well, what's left? What could it be based on? And what it's based on is the way we're interpreting what the news is, the story that we're telling about it. And so, you know, if you don't get a pay raise, you might say, well, there's no story to tell. I just don't get a pay raise. So what, you know, what's the story? How do I tell a different story? I can't pretend that I got, that I'm getting more pay. But what happens is if, you know, if we find out that we're not getting a pay raise, we might start doing these kind of snowballing, catastrophic thinking like, you know, I'm never going to get a pay raise, or I'm never going to do a good job, or I'm going to get fired soon. And then it can even work backwards where we start looking to the past and say, you know, I've never done anything right in my life, and I can't do anything right now. And I know this is about work, but I'm also not a good husband. I'm not a good father. And before you know it, it's just completely out of control. And so the sort of advice is not to pretend that you're, you know, getting an increase in salary, or to deny that you didn't get a pay raise, but to simply keep it the size that it is, to acknowledge this is what this is, this is what this means. But also, it's not about the past. It's not about, you know, have I ever done anything well in my life? It's not about the future in the sense that this means nothing good is ever going to happen to me again. when we sort of supersize the feedback, it gets out of control. And that's where that 40% of how we react can come in, is some people will sort of exaggerate things into the future and into the past. And other people are very good at sort of keeping it the size that it is. And some people are actually go in the other extreme, which is they don't take in the feedback at all, which is sort of a form of narcissism, which is not good either. So you want to be hearing the feedback, but keeping it the size it is, and keeping it meaning what it actually means, and not a whole lot more.
Right. So this idea of keeping things in proportion, this goes to, you know, the identity trigger, right? Whenever we receive feedback, exactly. It's like, boy, because I didn't get a pay raise, it means I'm a terrible employee. Because I'm a terrible employee, I'm a terrible husband, yada, yada.
Right. And yeah, if you actually got genuine feedback that all these terrible things were true about your past, about your present, about your future, you would be pretty depressed and unhappy, and you would spiral out of control. But the point is that in most of these kinds of situations, you're getting a very discrete piece of feedback, and then we're telling an exaggeratedly negative story about it. And that's just shooting ourselves in the foot.
And you talk about, you know, in order to avoid this identity trigger, you need to switch from a static mindset to a growth mindset. It's Carol Dweck's, I call it. We've had her on the podcast before.
Yeah. Oh, great. Yeah. So her work has been really interesting. Yeah. She talks about a fixed mindset and a growth mindset. Yeah. And in the fixed mindset, people think to themselves, I have a certain set of skills. Like I'm a certain amount of smart. I'm a certain amount of athletic. I have a certain amount of perseverance. And so that's fixed. And so the only thing that feedback does for me is it tells me what that amount is. So if I take a test in school, I'm finding out, am I smart or am I stupid? So when you go in and take a test on, you know, the Civil War or whatever the topic is, and you think that the feedback you're getting on the test is you're smart or you're stupid, and you find out, you know, either way, if you find out you're smart, now you're thinking, okay, I'm smart, but that puts pressure on me to keep being smart. If you find out you're stupid, you feel like, well, that's too bad. There's nothing I can do. I guess I'm one of those people who's you know, destined not to do well. And Dweck says, but, you know, why are we hearing it that way? We can just as easily think that these endowments that we have, whether, you know, about intelligence or athletic ability or empathy or whatever the skill is, these are things that we can get better at, right? And it's absolutely true that you can get better at virtually everything in your life. It's not to say everyone's going to be LeBron James in basketball or Yo-Yo Ma, you know, as a cellist. But, you know, we can all get better, and sometimes we can get a little better. Sometimes we can get a lot better. You know, even people that are really, really bad at math can get better at math. And there is no reason to think of that as just this fixed thing. And once you start thinking about it that way, then you get your test score back on the Civil War. And instead of thinking, oh, you know, I got a bad grade, that means I'm stupid, the information in this conversation is that I'm stupid. The information in this conversation is you don't know much about the Civil War, and the coaching is, so study differently, study harder, study more efficiently, you know, play fewer computer games, whatever. Those are all things that you have some power to influence, right? So you're not just stuck with a label. You can actually change it. And that gives you a lot of freedom to improve, but it also clears away some of the high stakes that we associate with all these measures along the way of our lives.
Yeah, I think this understanding the fixed and growth mindset and focusing on growth mindset is really useful for that evaluative feedback, or feedback you interpret as evaluative, right? Someone tells you, like, well, you're not that good, and you can interpret if you have a fixed mindset, well, I'll never be good. But if you have a growth mindset, well, okay, I'm not good now, but I can get better.
Right, exactly. And that very naturally takes you do hear the evaluation, you know, I'm not that good right now. And again, you're not pretending that that's not true. You're not pretending that you're the Civil War genius or whatever. But it also then, so you're hearing the evaluation, but then it quickly moves into coaching, which is, okay, if this is a thing that I can be better and worse at, and they're telling me I'm not good at it now, then the coaching is I gotta start doing things differently. And that gives you some power over the situation.
So let's talk about rejecting feedback. Because as you said, just because someone gives you feedback doesn't necessarily, you should consider it, but not necessarily take it into account or actually apply what they give you. You know, sometimes people are wrong. Sometimes you're not even looking for feedback. But rejecting feedback can be a minefield because, you know, if it's your wife and you're saying, yeah, I'm not really looking, they can get offended, or your mom, you know, like, why don't you listen to me? So how do you reject feedback tactfully?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And, you know, as you suggest, the context matters, right? If it's your supervisor saying you didn't hit your sales targets for this month, and you say, well, you know, that's not where I'm at right now. I'm not going to be working on that feedback. That might not go over so well. But there's lots of times in our lives for any number of reasons. And it can be because you really disagree with the feedback, or you think the feedback's good for the person who's giving it to you, but not good for you. Or it can just be, you know, that's not where you're at right now. You're working on 5 other things. You can't take on one more thing. There's lots of good reasons to set feedback aside. And I think the mistake that we make sometimes is we don't discuss that. We sort of hear the feedback, and in our minds, we're thinking, I would never take this feedback, or I can't possibly think about this right now. But then we just kind of leave it. And then the other person sees that we're not doing anything. And so they come back and they think, like, well, maybe they're not persuaded yet, or maybe they didn't hear it. And so they say it again, and then they say it again, and then they say it again. I think the better course is to actually say, you know what, here's what I'm hearing you suggesting to me, and here's what I think of that. Either it does or it doesn't make sense, and here's why right now, or maybe forever, why I'm not going to pursue that. And the person can agree or disagree. Very often, once you explain it, they'll say, like, okay, you know, I get that. But they can agree or disagree, but at least they know that you've heard the feedback, you've understood it, and it takes away that urge they have to just keep saying it over and over and over again. Another thing that I think can be useful is just to be very pointed about saying, tell me what the purpose from your point of view is of giving me this feedback. And then the person says, well, I want you to get better. And then if you can then tie it back and say, this feedback doesn't actually help me get better, and here's why. So I had a colleague once who, right before I'd go up and give a talk, he would give me a couple little things to remember. And he would do it over and over again. And from his point of view, he's just being as helpful as he possibly can. He's thinking, like, well, these are the things Doug's probably going to forget, so I just got to make sure he remembers them. And I started kind of saying, like, you know, don't give me advice right before I start talking. And he kept doing it. And he's thinking, but it's good advice, which maybe it is. And so then I did this move where I said, help me understand what your goal is. When you're giving me this advice, what's the goal? And he said, well, I just want to increase the chance that you're going to, you know, do this or remember to say this in your talk. And I said, okay, so it doesn't have that effect. It actually, to some extent, has the opposite effect, because what it does is it distracts me, makes me more nervous, and then I do worse. And, you know, once he heard that, he at least is sort of understanding the conversation from my point of view, and can back up and say, okay, so what would be a way that would be helpful that I could, you know, remind you about this? And, you know, the answer may be, tell me the night before, or let's talk about it after, and then I'll do it the next time, that sort of thing. But I think too often we just aren't clear about the actual impact on it.
I think that learning how to, I don't know, consider and reject feedback is particularly important in the internet, right? You can post something on Facebook and, you know, you're not looking for feedback. You're just kind of sharing something or whatever. And then, like, the cousin of your cousin chimes in with just some, you know, with their opinion on it. It's like, you need to do this, or I blah, 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 blah. And it's just like, oh,
right.
And for a lot of people, that can just like weigh on them, right? Just like how,
oh, yeah. Get,
receiving constant feedback via likes or comments on Facebook, Instagram, whatever. So how do you manage online feedback?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think we're all subject to this, is that the negative feedback stings much more than the positive feedback makes us happy, right? So, you know, if you get 100 comments and 99 of them are positive and one is negative, obviously the one you're going to remember, the one that's going to stay with you, is the negative one. So just for starters, it's good to be aware of that, that it's a common human reaction, is that the, you know, it, I think it has to do with sort of our evolution, that we're very sensitive to possible danger in the environment, and good things are good, and we want to pursue them. But danger is sort of urgent and an emergency. So when we see something, when we get that negative post, we're sort of wired to really focus on it. But with online stuff, my own reaction, my first. So one way that I get online feedback is the comments on Amazon about our books. And like most of the comments on Amazon, you know, they're mostly very positive, which is sweet and nice. But occasionally someone will have a negative comment, and my absolute first reaction is always something critical of that person in a sort of irrational, crazy way. So someone will say something like, this book is too long, or, you know, this book is too hard, or I don't know what. My reaction is, you know, that person's a jerk, or that person doesn't know how to read a book, or, like, you know, I don't have any information about this person. It could be Mother Teresa for all I know, but the first reaction I have is going to be negative, dismissive, and angry, because that's kind of what's going on with me physiologically, which is fine. But then I step back and I just try to see the situation more rationally and think, okay, there's, you know, X number of people are reading the book, X number of people are going to comment on the book. When they comment on it, some of them are going to have, you know, good reasons for not liking the book. Some of them are just going to be people that think it's fun to put up crazy comments. So sort of trying to get to remind ourselves what's really going on when people are posting some of those nastier comments. You know, they may, it's really, especially on the internet, I think it's rarely about the thing that's being commented on, and it's mostly about the person doing the commenting and what kind of mood they're in, you know, what they're trying to get off their chest, et cetera. Right. You know, but it's hard. We're all human beings trying to make it through. And when we see those kinds of negative feedback, even if we're thinking that's some, you know, drunk, angry guy at 3 a.m. in the morning who just wanted to get some aggression out, there's another part of us that's thinking, yeah, but maybe they're right. Maybe, you know, maybe this book sucks or whatever.
Yeah. I've had the drunk, angry guy leave emails at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, go on this tirade about something, why I'm wrong and why my site sucks, whatever. And I'll say, you know, hey, I thanks for reaching out, but you could have given that feedback a little more tactfully. And without fail, they always say, oh, I'm really sorry, I had a bad day yesterday. I got a little.
Yeah, exactly.
And I shouldn't have done that. It's really funny how that happens. Well, hey, Doug, this has been a great conversation. Where can people learn more about your book and your work?
The book's available on all the sites, Amazon and Barnes & Noble, et cetera. And my website, my company is called Triad, TRIAD Consulting Group. And the website is just that, all in one word, Triad Consulting Group. .com, and that leads you to anything you could ever possibly need to know.
Excellent. Well, Doug Stone, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
It's my pleasure to be here.
My guest today was Doug Stone. He's the author of the book, Thanks for the Feedback. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. You can also check out his site, stoneandheen.com, for more information about the book. Also, check out the show notes at aom.is/feedback for links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. Our show is edited by Creative Audio Lab here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. If you have any audio editing needs or audio production needs, check them out at creativeaudiolab.com. As always, I appreciate the continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, Essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.